Welcome back to the program. We all know that in the disease model of medicine, sometimes the way we cure a disease or prevent a disease is by giving small doses of that disease. We come up with the polio vaccine, the smallpox vaccine, even the flu vaccine takes flu virus and uses it to prevent the flu. Never has that model been applied to politics in this country, and yet that is exactly what the right seems to be doing. Their view is that the solution to deregulation is more deregulation. The solution to banks gone wild is banks going wilder. The solution to the excesses of unfettered markets is more deregulation. How did we get to this point? How did we get to this Alice in Wonderland view of American politics? We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Thomas Frank. He's the author of the best-selling books, The Wrecking Crew and What's the Matter with Kansas. It is my pleasure to welcome Thomas Frank back to this program to talk about Pity the Billionaire, the hard time swindle and the unlikely comeback of the right. Thomas Frank, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
It does feel sometimes like we're in Alice in Wonderland territory here, in that the solution to all of the problems is more of the things that cause the problems.
Yeah, we're living in a kind of upside down world, and I've been watching the Republican debates, the sort of circus as they go from state to state, and the candidates, sort of promising, each one trying to outdo the other in their commitment to overturning regulation, which is the strangest thing for them to be interested in, for the simple reason that deregulation, of the financial industry, which was our, that was our economic policy for the last 30 years, is what led very directly to the financial crisis and the economic slump that we're in.
And yet there is a way that the right is couching this discussion, and we see it in the debates, Newt Gingrich being the penultimate example, in terms of a kind of right-wing angry populism.
That's, yes, you've taken the words right out of my mouth. He was amazing the other day. The Republican candidates are they have a program that will wind up mainly benefiting the very wealthy, the powerful, the banking industry, that kind of thing. But that's certainly not how they address us, the people. The way they talk to us is by proposing a kind of populism, by raging against elites. You saw Gingrich's victory speech the other night.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of this long denunciation of the elites who run this country, and you think of his TV commercials. They aren't his, but his Super PAC's TV commercials about Mitt Romney, where, about Mitt Romney's career as a venture capitalist. And, I mean, to see these TV commercials is to get the impression that Newt Gingrich is some kind of 1930s liberal or leftist, I should say. Everything is sort of upside down.
Wasn't the core of this, though, when we go back and look at what was referred to at the time as Reagan Democrats, don't we see the roots of where we are today in this regard?
Absolutely. The white working class, according to all these demographic studies that they do, has been moving into the Republican Party slowly over the years, but now very quickly. And so you have a guy like Rick Santorum, who's best known for his stands on culture war issues. I mean, he may want to let banks go do what they want, but he really wants to supervise you and me and make sure we don't step out of line. But this is a guy who continually describes himself as a representative of working class America. That's totally what his campaign is about right now.
And doesn't this go back then to the premise that you had, that you laid out eloquently in What's the Matter with Kansas, that we see large swatches of the American public essentially going against their own economic interest?
Yeah, that's very definitely what is going on here, in my opinion. The Republican candidates probably wouldn't agree with me on that, but there's no doubt about it that the conservative policies that we've been sort of returning triumphantly to Congress and the White House over the last 30 years, that these policies have been disastrous for members of the middle class, for union members, for people that work in blue collar jobs. The America that I grew up in back in the 60s and 70s, where there wasn't this great divide between the social classes, that America is completely gone. And the reason it's gone is because of the you know, conservative economic policies of the last 30 years. So, you know, you might want to, you know, you might be offended by what they show on TV, but if you vote for these guys, you're actually just, you know, destroying your way of life.
How much of this also grows out of all of the change that has taken place, the social and cultural change that has happened within society, and of course all the fear and therefore anger that grows out of that, that really is the fertile ground of demagogic rhetoric?
Well, okay, that's you're talking about the larger story of our time is this sort of, you know, the great cultural shift. But in the last couple of years, those, you know, culture war issues have really moved onto a back burner, and there's a different fear, and that's, of course, economic collapse. And, you know, economic collapse is traditionally a time when you would see the public turning to liberals. You certainly saw that in the 1930s. You know, it seems natural that when you have the sort of fantastic economic failure like we've seen, that people want government to step in, make sure it doesn't happen again. Make sure that people, you know, that the victims of the downturn aren't, you know, that they survive, that everything works out okay. But what's happening this time is something very different. It's a very different response. It sounds the same, and it looks the same on the surface. You know, it sounds like the 1930s. A guy like Newt Gingrich, you know, sounds like a populist. But his, you know, and what's making his rise possible here is this fury over what's happened to us in the last couple of years. I mean, our economy is you know, in the dumps, and it just nothing seems to improve. You know, it's been 4 years now. People are furious. Now, then the sleight of hand, you know, the sort of trick, the hard time swindle, as I call it in the book, by which these guys put over policy, the very same policies that got us into this mess. That's very interesting. But on the surface, they seem to be. In fact, they are expressing the anger of the public.
One of the things that they've been so effective in doing, and maybe Gingrich more effective than any of the others, is in combining these two ideas, that the culture wars are somehow connected to the economic collapse, and the way in which the desire to go back to a simpler time becomes part of both messages.
Yes.
is part of what we're seeing here.
Yes, that is very true, that they don't... these guys don't really push economic issues as economic issues. They push them as moral issues, almost as culture war issues in their own right. And so you're supposed to be, you know, the idea of the market, for example, looms very large in what these guys say and do. And you might say, you know, if you were a historical observer like I like to think that I am, that we've been through a sort of great real-world test in the theory of free markets. You know, we've tried now for 30 years to put this thing into effect, and every step closer we get, the more, you know, booms and busts we have, bank runs, you know, these incredible disasters, okay? And yet these guys, the Republican candidates who are, you know, one of them is going to be the presidential candidate of the Republican Party, are saying, no, the answer is that we have to double down in our commitment to free markets. We have to, you know, be pure in our faith. We have to go much further than we've ever gone before, and then we'll get to that state, you know, that's like that they associate with the founders and with the past, and, you know, we'll get to this state of pure free markets where everything will be fine. And I don't know how many, I mean, on this book tour that I'm on right now for Pity the Billionaire, I mean, I just can't count the number of times that, you know, I'm on radio shows and people call in and say, no, Frank, you don't get it. You know, we still have, you know, big government in this country. Until the day we finally do away with big government and let the market be completely free, our problems will never be solved. You know, this is something that it's like a religious awakening or something. This is just, this idea has swept the country in the last 2 years, and it's amazing.
What do you see then as the nexus between this and the Republican Party trying to meld together its three legs of its current platform, both, you know, the sort of the Wall Street big business part of the Republican Party, this populist strain that Gingrich probably most effectively gives voice to, and the libertarian strain that we hear from Ron Paul?
Well, I think the libertarians are going to be disappointed. I mean, they'll get their way on economic issues. You know, they'll see more, you know, government hacked down. They'll see, you know, lobbyists running the regulatory agencies, all the sort of typical things that you see that you know, come together to sort of wreck the government in Washington D.C. That will happen, but they're not going to get their way on foreign policy, which is kind of a shame. I mean, I sort of give Ron Paul credit on that. The man stands up for civil liberties in the face of the national security state, you know, and I like that. They're not going to get their way on that, of course. But I mean, you just look at the contempt with which guys like Gingrich, you know, regard Ron Paul. You know, he's just completely outside of the consensus on the or of their consensus on foreign policy issues. But his economic ideas are widely shared. He's more he goes further than the others, but his economic ideas are very widely shared within the party.
One of the other things that we're seeing, though, is a sense that really what represents the Republican Party today more than policy is this angry tone, this vitriolic attitude. It manifests itself partly in response to Obama, but in general, this very angry tone that seems to be part and parcel of Republicanism today.
Yeah, and there you've really entered, you've opened up an interesting question, because this leads you very naturally to wonder, you know, where are the Democrats in all this? You know, we're talking about the angry tone, and that's you're very right there. I mean, this is what distinguishes these guys this time around, and it's what distinguished them in 2009 and 2010, when you saw the rise of the Tea Party movement and the, you know, them sweeping Congress, you know, is this tone of alarm. And the funny thing is, this is all stuff that they have borrowed from the historical left from the 1930s. And you know, I'm asking myself, where are the Democrats in all this? You know, why aren't they speaking to public anger? Why aren't they out there, you know, competing for the angry voter? The Democrats are supposed to be the party of working people, you know, the party of average folks, you know, the people who are really hard done by this recession. Why aren't they out there speaking to this in a kind of Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman way? And that's what the second half, if you will, of Pity the Billionaire is about, is their just complete failure, the Democrats' complete failure to address, you know, what is overwhelmingly the, you know, dominant political sentiment right now, which is this outrage that you're talking about.
It there was a touch of that in the speech that Obama gave in Osawatomie, Kansas, not too long ago.
That's right.
Which obviously,
that's right. In Kansas.
In Kansas, right. Which is obviously going to be, you know, or was a trial run of some of the themes of the campaign. Somehow that anger just doesn't seem to resonate in the same way when it comes from Barack Obama.
Well, that's right. But he's just, it resonated for me. I really liked that speech.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very predictably. Of course, I was really impressed by that. But, you know, that's me. He's also just getting started. I mean, these guys have a head start of, what, 3 years on him. You know, the Tea Party movement started up when he'd been president for a single month. You know, and they've been out there in the park yelling with their bullhorns and having their marches on Washington ever since. You know, and screaming without, you know, venting, giving voice to the people's outrage. And he's playing a serious game of catch up. There's also the huge problem that he is identified with, you know, the bank bailouts, and through them the various policies of the past. So, you know, and they don't have that burden. I mean, they do, of course, but they are able to deny it.
I mean,
now we're against the bailouts.
One of the things that they've been able to do, and you talk about this in the book, is they've actually been able to portray Obama in the Herbert Hoover role.
Well, yeah, but he's in some ways he's brought that on himself. I make a big comparison between Obama and Herbert Hoover, and I don't think it's unfair. And this has to do with the bailouts. You know, one of the things that intrigues me about the current political moment that we're in is how easy it was for the right to get out of. You know, the bailouts were started by George W. Bush, who was their great conservative leader. You know, they used to buy little statues of him. But it was George W. Bush and Hank Paulson, his Treasury Secretary, who masterminded the bailouts. And then Barack Obama came in and accepted, you know, voted for the TARP, which was the bailout law, and accepted the bailout policy of the Bush administration and kept it going, you know, embraced it as his own. And he thought this was a very noble act of bipartisanship. But it's the Tea Party movement and then the right generally was able to, you know, look at the bailouts, which were extremely unpopular, you know, this kind of unbelievable obscenity even. And the right was able to say, nope, that's not our doing. They just tossed George W. Bush overboard. And you hear this also from conservatives all the time. George W. Bush, not a real conservative, not part of our movement. You know, we are pure and believe in free market forces, and bailouts are obviously a violation of free market principle. Therefore, we have nothing to do with them. And, you know, they're an act of big government, of liberalism, plain and simple. And they've managed to essentially dump the entire blame for that moment on Barack Obama. And this is a really interesting thing, because this is the conservative movement's ace in the hole. This is the Trump card that they will always pull out and play in a bad situation. And so for Pity the Billionaire, I wanted to know about the history of bailouts. You know, and what I discovered is that, yes, conservatives have done lots of bailouts, over the course of the last century. Ronald Reagan, of course, bailed out Continental Illinois Bank. You know, Citibank has been bailed out by a sort of backdoor method several times. But the most interesting bailout chapter in American history is in the 30s. If this is getting boring and I'm getting in the weeds, you just tell me and I'll shut right up. But the Hoover administration bailed out banks, and the public hated it for exactly the same reasons as they did this time around. It was rampant cronyism, you know, guys in the administration bailing out their friends who were bank presidents. And Franklin Roosevelt did not, when he became president, he didn't just accept this, you know, in the spirit of bipartisanship in the way that Barack Obama did. He campaigned against it. He denounced these bailouts constantly. They didn't call them bailouts back then. They called them something else. But he denounced these all the time. And when he got into office, he kept doing bailouts, but he did them in a very different way that was designed to express his, you know, his hostility to Wall Street. He did the bailouts in a very different way. You know, they would routinely fire the management of banks that they were bailing out. We never do that anymore. Right. They would put banks out of business. You know, they would start up new banks if they felt like it. They did amazing things in those days, but none of that seems to be on the table anymore. We don't even know about it. It's this sort of forgotten chapter of history. And I think things would be very, very different if Barack Obama had taken a page from that, you know, from that history.
To what extent is race a part of this discussion? Not race in the sense that we certainly see at every opportunity the Republicans trying to paint him as some kind of alien from which we need to take back America, and we hear that rhetoric constantly, but also in preventing Barack Obama from getting as angry as he might want to get, and the danger of that given the racial issues that underlie it.
That's a very good question. You and I are thinking along the same wavelength here, and that's a point that intrigues me. All the language about Obama as, you know, he's got some kind of Kenyan, there's some sort of Kenyan core to him that's alien to America, and this is, you know, the suspicion that guys like Newt Gingrich have done their best to play up, and it's The thing is that at the same time, the Tea Party movement and conservatives generally go very far out of their way to try to avoid overt racism. I mean, they really bend over backward. They're very sensitive to being to charges of racism. But at the same time, of course, there's all these sort of outrageous moments of Tea Party racism. You know, so it goes. There's both things there, but the second question that you ask, is Obama himself constrained by his race from doing what he needs to do? I mean, I don't think that gets him off the hook. I think he could have like Joe Biden get out there and do it or something. I don't know. I mean, it's a really good question. I think of guys like Jesse Jackson who are bearers of a populist message and very effective ones. Jesse Jackson back in the 80s and the 90s, he was really good at it. Now, maybe Jesse Jackson is very unpopular with the general public. I don't know. But I remember all sorts of incidents where he was, or chapters or episodes or however you want to put it, where he was very effective at that, at bearing that message. But Barack Obama, you know, I don't know if it's conditioned on his race or not, but he is, I mean, I'm not privy to the man's soul. I have met him.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one way that I was kind of surprised to figure this out. When he first came to Washington and when he was running for president in 2008, he often spoke as though the great problem in American life was partisanship, and that he would bring this new tone of civility and centrism to Washington, D.C. And I thought that was obvious, you know, window dressing and, you know, filigree that didn't mean anything, because every president says things like that. But it turns out that's really who he is. That's what he really thinks. And you know, he essentially came to Washington, you know, utterly unprepared for this moment when civility is not the answer. It is manifestly not the answer.
Right. It's a little like the bully on the playground that finds the kid that won't fight back, that in fact, you know, will try to find some other way to defuse the situation, but not fight back on the
playground.
That's
right. And so in some ways, all this sort of crazy rhetoric about Obama as a communist and, you know, all of this kind of this insane stuff that you hear at right-wing rallies, and you sometimes even hear it from presidential candidates, you know, this sort of outrageous, oh, it was Newt Gingrich that said that the Obama administration is a greater threat to America than the Nazis or the Soviets, you know. And so one of the reasons this stuff happens is precisely because he doesn't fight back, that the rhetoric gets more extreme.
Is that perhaps its own solution to all of this, that the rhetoric is getting so extreme, particularly because of Gingrich, that it will ultimately create the necessary crack-up?
Oh, that's a really depressing thought. You mean for the Democrats?
For the Republicans.
I think that they've got to do something to retaliate. I mean, well, we'll see. I mean, maybe the Republicans will push it over the edge. Maybe they will shoot themselves in the foot. But the problem with that theory is that that's what everyone thought last time around, that the Republicans had gone too far, you know, in 2008. They'd gone too far. They had, you know, they had run the country off a cliff with their crazy free market economic policies, you know, trying to deregulate banks and mortgage lenders and all that sort of stuff that they did. And now they had, this is what all the pundits said in 2008, they had to, after the defeat after, you know, the humiliation of George Bush, they had to become moderate. They didn't. They did the opposite. They became a more concentrated, more conservative party, you know, and they were throwing the moderates out, you know, at one point. And they succeeded in doing this. It wasn't a recipe for disaster. It was successful in 2010. They had this great sweeping victory. You know.
Talk a little bit about the Occupy movement, which seems to have, in some respects, tried to fill this void on the left of getting angry and fighting back.
Yeah, that's the way I see it. There's been one of the reasons that the that conservatives have been so successful with this sort of outrageous rhetoric that they've been using for the last couple of years, is that there is no competing take on, you know, what's gone wrong in this country. You know, you certainly don't hear it from Democrats. There's no populism there anymore, or very, very little. I mean, there are some good Democrats out there, but I mean, from the leadership of the party, you don't hear that stuff. And so one of the reasons that the Tea Party movement was so successful was that there was no competition. They didn't have anybody competing to try to describe this obscene situation with bank bailouts and economic failure and this kind of thing. But all of a sudden, beginning at the tail end of last year, they did have competition. And I think that's immensely important. And the Tea Party movement, sorry, excuse me, the Occupy Wall Street movement, I make that mistake a lot, you know, I think that tells you something.
Yes.
But the Occupy Wall Street movement, you know, it speaks to the economic situation in a much more straightforward and sensible manner. I mean, I am the 99% campaign. I thought that was really moving. I thought that was really powerful, and it had a big effect. Now, they need to keep going. This movement needs to keep rolling, and we need to, you know, see what the next stage is in it. But yes, it has the power to completely change the conversation.
Why has the argument, in your view, that the left has become too elitist, you know, terrible thing that they believe in history and science and everything else?
Yeah, yeah.
Why has that argument been so resonant, in your opinion?
I think there's a couple of reasons, and one of them is that, I mean, to a certain degree, it's, you know, it's true. There was a time when, as I mentioned earlier, the Democrats were very definitely the party of working people, and that's who they were. And today, though, if you talk to big Democratic strategists in Washington, D.C., what they are becoming and what they want to become is the party of the professional class. And so Democrats tend to, you know, they come out of academia, they respect expertise, they respect learning, and hey, those are good things. It's very important to do that, but it has become sort of the brand identity of their party. They are the party of the technocrats, you know. They promise to be able to run the machine better than Republicans do, and they've left the field completely open for the Republicans to make their populist appeals. And, you know, it's kind of a long and twisted and complicated story about, you know, who funds the parties and why it is that Democrats have chosen to remake themselves as the party of technocrats. but they definitely have done that, and so when they, you know, they call them elitists, they're referring, of course, to to people who are well educated, and the charge sticks. Now the obvious response, you know, is to talk about the real powers that be in our country, and it's not educated people, you know, it's Wall Street, you know, it is free market capitalism running wild, you know. It's actually a really easy thing to do to talk about that, but Democrats will not do it. So they counter this elitism message, and you heard Newt use that word I don't know how many times in his victory speech the other day.
Right. I mean, that was the joke that somebody could turn that into a drinking game every time he said the word elite.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to keep that in mind for his next victory speech. But, you know, the obvious way to beat that is to talk about, you know, who really holds power in this country, who really has the economic power in this country. And it's not, you know, guys that went to Harvard, you know. Or it's not guys who have PhDs. I mean, I'm here to tell you, I've got one of those, a history PhD, and that's like, you know, that's a sure ticket to the unemployment line. But they won't make that argument, okay? And this is what frustrates about the Democratic Party. They will not make that argument. They won't come out and say those things that need to be said. They won't talk about the nature of the economy in a way that people recognize, you know, and that rings true to them. They just won't do it.
Of course, on the other side, because the Tea Party movement and this right movement that we're talking about is an older part of the population and a constantly aging part of the population, and because the Tea Party has gone out of its way not to invite young people to be part of the equation, it is a kind of self-defeating process at this point.
Yeah, that's right. But you aren't going to believe this. They actually see it the other way around. That generation that grew up in the 30s and the 40s is the generation that's slowly disappearing. The people who actually remember the Great Depression, and that's that generation, as you know, was very Democratic. You know, the people who mm-hmm. voted for Roosevelt. So they, you know, but you're absolutely right. I mean, what is the future in all this? You know, I don't know the answer to it. But I would suspect that, you know, and this is the other thing that you'll hear from Democrats in Washington, is that they don't need to do anything because the demographics of the country mm-hmm. all point in their direction. So they don't really need to raise a finger. You know, they don't need to go out there and say awkward things that might make their relationship to their, you know, funders, to their billionaire backers, might make that relationship difficult or fraught. They don't need to say those things. They don't need to counter elitism with elitism. You know, they don't need to have a vision, an ideological vision of where we should be as a country. They don't need to do a damn thing because they're going to win automatically. Now, the problem with them, and I'm not, you know, exaggerating here. This is, you hear this all the time. The problem with that is, of course, it assumes that the Republicans can't come up with a way, a strategy for countering that. And, of course, they can. And it's really evil, and that is to restrict the franchise somehow. I mean, to find some way of discouraging people from voting. And that is, I think that may well be what we see next.
Thomas Frank. His book is Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, just out from Metropolitan Books. Thomas, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine.
Thank you.